UK Defence, The Way Ahead by Godfrey Bloom. The Libertarian Party in the United Kingdom commissioned Godfrey Bloom to give an independent analysis as to the state of our military defences and procurement. For libertarians, defence is the only legitimate role of the state. Our stance is purely on defence, not speculative overseas adventures by our political masters. Godfrey confirms the feeling the Defence Policy Committee of the party had, that for all the defence spending, much is misdirected and strategically unsound. The following is not current party policy but reflects our thinking. Our policy will be put to our conference in February 2019. Andrew Withers, Chairman. Defence of the realm, the primary role of government? No longer, it seems. Indeed, almost everything but. The NATO target for British defence spending is 2% of GDP. An eccentric measure, but let us take that as a fair figure for the defence of modern Britain. Properly allocated, it is plenty. Sadly, defence budgets are and have been squandered for over 150 years. Defence now is all about pork barrel politics in the Western democracies, coupled with political and bureaucratic incompetence. Here I want to look at how things could be drastically improved with no increase in expenditure, just some common sense and a realistic strategic geopolitical strategy. What is defence for? Amazingly, this question is never answered. Senior military, naval and air commanders can't agree amongst themselves. Resentment is sometimes caused inter-service because airmen seem to have the ear of politicians, or at least are better at presenting their budgetary case to ministers who prefer their priority, the distribution of wealth, to their political clientele. There are few votes in defence in times of peace. Defence should be just that, not military adventurism, aggressive posturing or subjection to the geopolitical maneuvering of American or continental powers. Since the winding down of the British Empire, the UK has remained a maritime trading nation but only a regional military power. The British have had trouble accepting this since the end of World War II. The structure of British defence since the collapse of the Soviet Union has morphed into a subdivision of the American military superpower NATO forward policy. America has over 200,000 overseas military personnel and 800 overseas bases. This is a significantly broader military footprint than the British Empire even at its zenith. The United States might not need British military or naval support, but the US State Department craves international credibility, with Britain as its bitch. The Americans can give a veneer of respectability to military adventurism in Africa, the Middle East and South China Sea. This is both irrational, dangerous and expensive. For a realistic defense strategy, a threat has to be established. This was easy in the old days of the Soviet Union. They were the bad guys, the bogeymen. Them and us. NATO was the counter to it. Largely American manned and funded, with a small but significant contribution by the British Army of the Rhine. I was a tiny cog in that machine for 20 years. However, those days, like the days of empire, have gone. From where now is the threat? Spheres of influence. I go into this subject in a little more detail in a previous article for Going Postal and British Reform magazines, but simplistically, the concept is a pragmatic assessment of who has a right to be where. Now, the libertarian fundamentalist would no doubt argue no one has a right to be anywhere except their own house and garden. They would, of course, be correct. But if libertarian solutions are to escape the philosophical laboratory, they have to meet reasonable expectations of the citizen who feels entitled to a degree of national protection. The CIA strategic dogma is and has been since 1960 that the Americans are the saviors of the world, and there is no corner of the globe which should not succumb to their influence and enslavement to the petrodollar, often referred to as regime change. This view is endorsed by the budget-hungry military-industrial congressional complex of which President Eisenhower warned. Interestingly, often forgotten now, a similar warning was given over 170 years earlier by none other than George Washington. Sadly, the Western democracies don't teach history. Which countries have legitimate spheres of influence? Everyone, of course. But not all have the wherewithal to enforce them. Turning to Great Britain in days of empire, the route to India was accepted as such: the Suez Canal, Mediterranean, plus the global trading routes. The empire counterintuitively was based primarily on trade, not military conquest. Hence a small army but massive navy. Those days have gone, as indeed has the Soviet Empire, so spheres of influence have reduced but are nonetheless deemed vital for powerful nations. The world would be safer if these spheres of influence were accepted by negotiation and protocol in the interest of a lasting peace, which is generally desired by most of us who are not registered Washington neocon nut jobs or huge shareholders in armament manufacturers. Britain must accept the Russian Federation has legitimate interests in the Baltic, Black Sea and land borders, that China has interests, as a major exporter, in the South China Sea. America would do best to rein in the global pursuit of world military domination for which they borrow $800 billion per and accept their sphere of influence is the North Atlantic, Caribbean, Gulf of Mexico and Eastern Pacific. Britain has legitimate interest in the North Sea, English Channel, Western Approaches and extended airspace as an island nation. The UK has no business putting troops into the Middle East, Baltic States or the Ukraine, nor sponsoring the new forward NATO policy. UK defence policy should be just that. Defence. In other words, Great Britain must be strong to deter attack. Other countries must look to their own defence. Treaties since the collapse of communism are anachronistic. The new proposed Entente Cordiale with the European Union, European Defence Union see previous articles, is especially dangerous. Oh dear, there we go again, history, an unknown discipline to the modern politician. What does Britain need for all-round defence? A new strategic dogma. The old dogma looks to the past. The military and naval high command love to fight past wars but with a hunger for updated weapons of yesteryear. This is and always has been disastrous. History is littered with examples. I offer just a few. The failure of Britain and her allies to learn the consequences of trench warfare from the American War of Southern Independence in 1861/4. The reliance on capital ships and failure to comprehend submarine warfare from 1914, particularly in merchant ship protection. Failure of modernizing Royal Navy gunnery systems and training pre-1914, see Sir Percy Scott autobiography. The air threat at sea to capital ships, HMS Prince of Wales and Repulse sunk by the Japanese, even after sea exercises in the Mediterranean in 1938 highlighted capital ship vulnerability. The dangers of static defense against coordinated and concentrated air and armor, Maginot Line, no lessons learned from Namur, Metz and Sedan in 1914. Exposed in French military exercises in 1937. The most effective way of protecting the UK from threat from any quarter is to refrain wherever possible of provoking a war. Most wars are expensive in blood and treasure and benefit no one. Occasionally war is inevitable. A classic example for Britain was the Falkland Islands. British flag, British people, invaded by a totalitarian foreign power. No arguments, straightforward black and white, we had to fight. But do the British want a war to promote an American-sponsored pipeline in southern Syria? Or increase the export of marijuana from Afghanistan, or immigrants from the Horn of Africa? Do we want to indulge in regime change in countries most Brits or Americans couldn't mark on a map? Has anybody read up on Russian history to ascertain why Russia feels the Crimea and Ukraine are legitimate spheres of influence? Do we really believe the Chinese are going to sail up the Channel and shell Brighton, or somehow they don't have a legitimate presence in the South China Sea? Britain has to be ready for war, including cyber war, a likely future battlefield. So how can we go about it? Where are we now? Defense budgets are interesting to examine. Numbers always cut through propaganda. The USA spend just under $800 billion every year, unaudited, a mind-boggling figure, The increase this year at $81 billion alone is more than the entire Russian Federation defense budget. The US Navy has 11 aircraft carrier groups with two more on the way. Carriers incidentally are force projectors, nothing much to do with defense. The British will have two when they eventually become operational, the French one, China one and one pending Russia likewise. The pecking order in military spending is America, China, Russia, Saudi and Great Britain at fifth. Given the UK has no land border to protect and has a tiny fraction of land mass of Russia or China, it is an astonishingly generous budget. Which country is a threat therefore, if we assume Great Britain doesn't provoke a confrontation? Correct, none, win a coconut. What do we get for our annual £35 billion? Fascinatingly, the smallest army per capita in our history and more civilian employees than the Navy, Marines and Air Force combined. We get four on-station nuclear deterrent submarines. Nuclear deterrence is a necessary evil given the inevitable proliferation of nuclear weapons. Yet the Trident system is an unnecessary expense. The Astute-class submarine can deliver home-manufactured tactical nuclear warheads up to a range of 1,000 miles. Moreover, they would be genuinely independent, free of any American involvement. A huge cost saving for exactly the same deterrent effect. Britain has 7 Hunter-killer submarines, this should be expanded to 12. Remember, if we had left one on station, the Falkland Islands would never have been taken. The Astute submarine is a first division vessel. A strategic submarine force of this capacity is an unanswerable international bargaining chip. The Royal Navy has always had an important global international relations role. Frigates are ideal for policing international waters where piracy is rife and all-round merchant marine protection. Traditional goodwill, showing the flag visits are a natural extension of their duties. It is also a popular recruitment and retention policy. The need for mobile and rapid response demands a significant increase in Royal Marine Commandos and Special Forces. Britain remains a regional power, it must retain teeth at a tactical level. Fighter squadrons are an integral part of our island defense program and have been since 1940. I am assured after a recent USAF briefing in Arizona this year, the latest F-35 is far and away the most effective air combat machine in an air-to-air role. Weaknesses in payloads, range and carrier capability are less relevant for home-based defense. The ludicrous aircraft carrier vanity project must go. A huge expensive white elephant, a weapon system of a bygone age. A retired American Cold War pilot friend quipped to me last month in Philadelphia, they've been redundant since Okinawa. Submariners have suggested to me under the Chatham House rule they would not last long in theater against a first-rate power. Inshore vessels are essential for coastal protection. The main likelihood of confrontation is low-level terrorist activity, fishery protection and illegal economic immigration. Purpose-built vessels are essential under a new Royal Navy, Coast Guard arm. 40 fast vessels with a small complement of Royal Marines on permanent coastal patrol, with integral shore-based drone capability. The Army. Is there a solution to the perennial problem of a small army with no apparent role? There is. A return to the concept of a properly equipped territorial army. As recently as the early 1980s, the territorial army was both funded and trained to a very high level. Divisional exercises Crusader and Lionheart proved their worth in bringing the regular army to fighting core strength. The emphasis should be on specialist and logistical roles where civilian skills dovetail. As the territorials don't qualify for pensions, annual bounties can be very generous, civilian employers must be incentivized to cooperate fully. In past years, employers realized the benefit of having military-trained personnel working for them, especially in junior executive roles. Senior regular peacetime officers have never fully understood the benefit of a volunteer wing, unlike their wartime forebears. They pay lip service, but territorial experience is not a requirement for senior command. It should be, Officer roles for regulars currently include warrant officers, adjutants, training majors and commanding officers. It must be remembered big wars are won by civilians in uniform. For those in any doubt, research the yeomanry in North Africa and Normandy. Or the Battle of Kohima in Burma, fought and won largely by territorials. The role of territorials should be taught at RMA Sandhurst and staff colleges. The contribution in the last war by the Royal Navy Volunteer Reserve speaks for itself. Army recruitment and retention has been shambolic in recent years. Abandonment of Crown exemption, harassment of elderly veterans, limited career prospects as the forces shrink and criminal underfunding of the reserves, in some cases just paper soldiers. The most recent disaster, £130 million wasted on trying to recruit online. Any junior NCO could have foreseen that horlicks. No one takes the Queen's shilling online. Only a bureaucrat could have come up with that idea. Where do we go from here? A root and branch reappraisal of geopolitical strategy. A complete withdrawal from many treaty entanglements. The reinforcement of soft power influence, international encouragement for army, naval and air force officer training. Sandhurst, Cranwell, Dartmouth, Joint Services Staff College, Shrivenham, Royal College of Defence Studies. International exchanges and secondment all have a role. A major cull of the 60,000 ministry civilian staff. Per capita and budget appropriation show Israel manage with 12% of this number. The mod must roll over annual budgets. No more blind ammunition firing to secure next year's allocation. Abandon use it or lose it, an eccentric public sector phenomenon. Procurement. Procurement is the black hole of military, naval and air budgets. There is an inherent weakness in the entire public sector where fiscal discipline is not an inherent in the civil service DNA. Defense is not as spendthrift as the NHS, but there is much to do. Significant penalty clauses for weapon system development, late or faulty delivery. Disciplinary measures for military procurement incompetence. Does the army really need a top civilian spec German truck for £120,000? Would not four basically equipped helicopters be more useful than one highly specced? Certainly that was the feedback I got when in Afghanistan from field commanders. The Armed Forces Parliamentary Scheme facilitating open access for parliamentarians, a concept initiated by a great patriot General Sir Neil Thorne, must be reinforced. A visiting VIP minister will only ever hear what a senior officer believes he wants to hear. Graduation from the scheme should be mandatory for all defense ministers whose quality and commitment appear to deteriorate with each new appointment. Significant bounties to retain key personnel are much cheaper than the stop-go recruitment and training merry-go-round. Enhanced pensions for lower ranks paid for by capping the almost ludicrous excesses of public sector pensions. Public relations. A government initiative to encourage higher quality of defense correspondence in the MSM. Particularly public service broadcasting. The current crop of journalists are very poor quality. Most could not even identify badges of rank, regimental or corps cap badges. Yet MSM paper or TV program editors and producers insist on top sportsmen for the sports pages. Perhaps favored access to more committed correspondents. There is a strong role for middle management input on procurement and recruitment policy. Very senior officers can lose touch, worse become politicized. Promotion to three-star rank should not be dependent on political correctness. A policy that has all but killed the police force. Beware the phrase used of a general or admiral who knows his way around Whitehall. It will portend transgender vegans for command appointments by quota. Recruitment based on skin color or gender is abhorrent, patronizing and counterproductive. Currently the mod website promotes this policy on its website. Naval and military recruitment and promotion should be on merit and merit alone. The quality of British working uniforms should be brought back up to scratch. Overseas poor quality kit brings down morale, False economy. Dress a man like a loser and he will become one. Incredibly recently moved from Yorkshire to China. There should be a much tighter safety net for discharged soldiers who have suffered trauma. Personnel selected for this duty should be better trained than currently seems the case. There is no shortage of funds in military charities for this project. Godfrey Bloom is the holder of the Territorial Decoration and Bar and Sovereign's Medal. Senior graduate of the Armed Forces Parliamentary Scheme. He is a published military historian and AS. Member of the Royal College of Defence Studies. Copyright Godfrey Bloom 2019.